Hey, welcome back for a special solo chat version of Amazing Gamers. I just had a topic that came up and I just want to take it on today because it's really fresh in my mind. So organizing the chats, I love it, but sometimes it takes a little bit. And this one, I feel like I got to roll with today, so I'm just going to post it. The thing I want to talk about today is the Silmarillion movie, which is basically one of those things that comes up every so often in the Tolkien fandom. I wrote a piece this week about the five people you meet in the Final Fantasy discourse. One of those people is the court jester, the stainless poop pile stirrer. Basically, I think in the Tolkien fandom, that person's favorite topic is the Silmarillion movie, because I don't think anyone's seriously talking about it happening, but somehow it appears in the discourse because it always moves the needle with either people who know nothing about the book and are curious for another Tolkien adventure, which I totally identify with, by the way. That was me in grade school. So I identify, and I love that. And I can totally identify with that. And then there's people who've actually read the Silmarillion, like me, and they know that there's all sorts of challenges with that. And basically the thing that always comes to mind for me is like, okay, what would that look like? And that's sort of where I could see a lot of ways it would probably be done, based on adaptations I've seen before. And for me, I think the Silmarillion is one of the great hidden gem stories in the world. I think it's tremendous. I think it has moments in it that are fantastic. Every bit as good as The Lord of the Rings in a different way. And I want that to really debut onto like the public consciousness in the best possible way. Like if I had a choice between a bad adaptation and no adaptation, I would take no adaptation until it's done right. So that's why when people talk about it, I'm always like really curious. I'm like, okay, at first I used to just say no, because I think there's a lot of challenges and I just don't see it really happening the right way. Now I'm open-minded. I'm like, okay, you want that. What would it look like? And I have my own thoughts on what it should look like. And that's kind of an interesting discussion that I'm definitely interested in having with people. The thing about the Silmarillion, it's like, I feel like being a Tolkien fan is kind of a progressive thing. You start out with The Hobbit as a kid. All kids love The Hobbit because Bilbo is the little guy, and kids can identify with Bilbo because they're the little guy too. There's like that common ground with Bilbo. And then The Lord of the Rings will come after, you know, and that's great fun and awesome, and the movies were incredible, and they generated a lot of excitement about it. And I think a lot of people kind of stop at the end of the movies, because after that, there's no real clear through line to go with Tolkien unless you've really dug in. Now, for me, if I was recommending talking to someone who'd only read Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, I would say the next thing you'd want to read is probably the Tolkien Atlas, because that gives you the maps of all the stories that Tolkien did in Middle Earth, and the maps are key. If you think about what got you into the Lord of the Rings, if you're anything like me, it was looking in the front of the book and seeing that map of the fantasy world and wondering where you were going to go there and all these cool things and just all these places to go and see, which is really what the book is about. So I think the map is really crucial there. If you get the Atlas of Middle-earth, you have the maps for all the stories. You also have the timeline of Middle-earth so that it all makes sense. I have friends who only read through the end of Lord of the Rings. They didn't know where to go. I lent them the Atlas and suddenly they're like, next thing I know, they're reading the appendices to the Lord of the Rings, which are at the end of Return of the King. And those are really good. Like, it leads with its worst foot. It starts with the language stuff and how to pronounce names, which is understandable because Tolkien was a philologist. He was primarily interested in language and old stories that he found with language. So that was kind of where he was coming from. I've heard it said that he created Middle-earth after he created the language for it. I don't know if that's true or not. But definitely the language is kind of a barrier. But if you get past the language in Appendices A, if you start getting into like the history of Gondor and the history of Rohan and the history of the dwarves in the Third Age, there's a Tale of the Years, which actually gives you a chronological table of what happens, which is not as interesting as actually reading the story, but it's still informative. But there's a lot of good thing in the appendices. If you read the appendices to The Return of the King and you're still interested, then basically you're prepared for the Silmarillion, because the Silmarillion is similar to the appendices in The Return of the King. And I've heard that Tolkien originally wanted to publish Lord of the Rings and Silmarillion as a package deal. He wanted the two to be contingent. There wouldn't be Lord of the Rings without Silmarillion. Eventually, he had to give up on that, is my understanding, and just go with Lord of the Rings. And he worked on the Silmarillion probably for the rest of his life. I don't think he ever finished it. You can get a clear sense of a lot of things he wanted to do with it, though. And the story that is there is pretty awesome and compelling. And really, it begins at the beginning. Like, it is a creation myth for Middle-earth, and it focuses on the First Age, which was largely the Age of Elves. And elves are really center stage in the Silmarillion. And it's basically, you have, like, the gods of Middle-earth, for lack of a better phrase. They're not called that, but that's what they are. And they're in Middle-earth. They live in Middle-earth in the Silmarillion at the beginning of days. And the elves come along. The elves are the first children of the true god. There's like one god, and then there's like, I guess the gods in the Silmarillion are really more like angels, I suppose. There's like one true god who creates everything, and then there's the Valar, who are like the angels, and they're like, you know, they're kind of like the Olympian pantheon a bit. They each have something they govern. They're very powerful, but they're not all powerful. And the most powerful of the Valar is a guy named Melkor, who has like all the gifts of all of them. But he also wants to sort of supplant the true god. He's kind of a Satan character in some respects, that he's wants to do things his way. He has his own ideas for what creation should be. There's an opening scene at the beginning of the Silmarillion. This is the stuff that people bounce right off of. But basically, it compares Eru, who is the one god. His plan for Middle-earth is expressed through music. It's music. And he's leading the chorus, and everyone else is invited to join in with their part. It's actually kind of awesome, like, if you think about it. But it's not, like, if you're looking for hobbits and Gandalf, that ain't it. But if you're interested in, like, an epic story of the creation of the world, it's basically they're all playing music together. Melkor wants to create his own music, and he challenges the Eru to sort of create his own music. And Eru's like, flips the hand and is like, yeah, okay, that's nice. That was actually part of my plan too. Allow me to demonstrate. And then it shows you like the three different movements of his plan for the earth, which are the stories that Tolkien would eventually tell. Now, the Silmarillion has a lot to do with elves, because elves are the first of the free people to awake. And they are like first just sort of living out by this lake, and there's no sun or moon. It's just dark all the time. It's twilight. But there's stars, like Elbereth, who's mentioned several times in Lord of the Rings. She's like the Hera character, I guess. She's like the second most powerful of the Valar. She creates the stars. The mirror of the file of Galadriel had the light of Elbereth in it. So she creates the stars. That's why the elves love the stars so much. It's because when elves first awoke, they were under the stars. But Melkor was kidnapping elves and turning them into orcs. So the Valar invited the elves to come live with them in their area, which was not Middle-earth. It was across the sea. And it was a place called the Undying Lands. And a lot of the beginning of the Silmarillion, basically the whole first movie would take place in the Undying Lands, because the whole beginning of the story is the elves living in the Undying Lands, and Melkor, who rebelled against the gods, is given a chance to reform. He's put away for three long ages. He's like imprisoned, and in that time the elves come to live in the Undying Lands. Melkor is eventually released because they don't think that he's forever evil, and he's in the Undying Lands, and he's trying to work trouble with the elves. He wants to derail whatever good things they can do. And a lot of the first movie would focus on the rivalry between Melkor and Fëanor, who is the lord of the elves called the Noldor. There's three kindreds of the elves in the Silmarillion. There's the Vanyar, which are the highest of elves that live in the Undying Land, and nobody's ever seen or heard of any of them. The only time you even get close to one is, I think, one of Galadriel's parents was a Vanyar elf. That's why she has blonde hair. They're known for having blonde hair. So you don't ever actually see a Vanyar elf ever really in Tolkien, because they live in the Undying Land. They always have. The ones you do see are the Noldor, and Galadriel is a Noldor. She's the second most powerful of the Noldor. By the time of the Lord of the Rings, she's the only one from the First Age that's still around.
Gil-galad was also a Noldor. He was the last High King of the Noldor in Middle-earth. He died at the end of the Second Age fighting Sauron alongside Elendil and Isildur. But the Noldor are the elves that Melkor is able to have some progress with, because the Noldor are very craft-minded. They make things. They're like the dwarves. They're friendly with the dwarves. And Melkor is able to use that because he has a lot of knowledge on how to create things. So the greatest of the Noldor was a guy named Fëanor. He was, you know, a prince of the people, and he's very proud and willful and skilled and powerful. And, like, there's a funny anecdote where Galadriel, like, took one look at him and could tell he was trouble. And, like, the two of them were never friends. Fëanor actually asked Galadriel for some of her hair to make something with it. She refused him. She immediately didn't like him, which, by the way, is great setup, because if you read The Lord of the Rings, she gives her hair to Gimli. It's because she can tell that Gimli is worthy and she can see where he's coming from. Fëanor, she never trusted. And with good reason, because Fëanor and Melkor work together. Like, Melkor is sort of a mentor to Fëanor and teaches him to become, like, the greatest craftsman ever, like the greatest alchemist, the creator of magic items, what have you. So that would kind of be central to it. But the thing is that Melkor all along is still plotting evil. And the way that he does it, you know, spoilers, but at that time, there's no sun or moon. There's, like, this thing called the Two Trees in the Undying Lands, which provide the light. They have, like, the golden light of one and the silver light of the other, and they light and they wax and wane. Well, Melkor sneaks in with a giant spider and destroys the trees. And, oh, yeah, wow, okay, I just messed up the telling of it. All right, let me back up. This is a really important point. So Fëanor, at the height of his craft, is able to capture the light of the two trees into these three gems called the Silmarils. That's what gives the book its name. They're the Silmarils. They're these holy artifacts, highest of the highest, pinnacle of craftsmanship from any of the free people in the Middle Earth, you know, in all of creation. He creates the three Silmarils, and they blaze hotly, and they'll burn anything that's evil. It's never really explained what the power of them is, but they have the light of the two trees, which is, like, if you read about the First Age, the elves who went to the Undying Land and saw the light of the two trees became more powerful. Galadriel is, like, one of the only elves who saw the two trees at the time of the Lord of the Rings, who's still in Middle Earth. So it, like, makes them more powerful. It has a different sort of light, a different sort of power. It's kind of hard to explain. But after Melkor and the spider destroy the trees, the Valar discover that they can bring the trees back, but only if they unlock the light that was captured from the trees in the Silmarils. So they put the request to Fëanor, can you give us the Silmarils, your masterpiece, so that we can restore the two trees and thwart Melkor's plan? Fëanor refuses. He thinks it's his, which it is, he built it, but he will give them to nobody. And he kind of paranoidly suggests that this was their plan all along, to invite them to their land, give them a perfect place to live, so that he would make the Silmarils and they could take them. That's kind of how Fëanor thinks. He's very prideful, it's just kind of how he is. He's a little prickly. So he's going to refuse the Valar, and then he finds out that Melkor actually stole the Silmarils, killed his father. His father was the only one back at Fëanor's fort. Melkor kills Fëanor's father, steals the Silmarils, goes back to Middle-earth, where his fortress is north of Beleriand, which is where most of the Silmarillion takes place. So at this point, Fëanor is like, gather up the troops, we are going to go get the Silmarils back. And the Valar deny permission for him to leave. Partly because of things that Fëanor did. Like, I'm condensing the story. There's reasons why they don't want Fëanor to leave. Fëanor defies them, and he swears an oath with his seven sons that nothing will ever keep the Silmarils from him and his family. That basically, it's like a vendetta for the Silmarils. If anyone tries to take them, they will take it back by force. And this oath drives a lot of the action for the rest of the story, because it comes back to bite them. I'm not going to tell the whole Silmarillion today, but this is crucial to understand the whole story. This is why I have serious doubts on a movie adaptation, because you need to know everything I just said for the story to make any sense. Like, you need to know those baselines, because the story of Beren and Lúthien, which is the first great epic tale in the Silmarillion, is completely bound up in the story, because Beren falls in love with the princess of elves. Her father doesn't support the union, says if you steal one of the Silmarils from Melkor, who, by the way, is called Morgoth. Fëanor names Melkor Morgoth, which is the black enemy of the world, is, I think, or something like that. The original Dark Lord. He names him the original Dark Lord. That if he can steal one of the Silmarils from Morgoth's crown, he'll give him his daughter's hand in marriage. He'll bless their wedding, I think, is the thing. Because Lúthien wants to marry Beren, but her father will not allow it. So that's, like, directly tied in with everything I just said for setup. And Beren and Lúthien should be its own movie. It's a huge epic story, and it's pretty awesome. It's one of the best stories in the Silmarillion. It does not, you cannot properly tell that story without everything I just said as lead-in. And oh, by the way, there's a ton of other stuff. There's, like, the war of the elves against the original Dark Lord over a period of, like, 400 years. And, like, they establish all these great kingdoms in Middle-earth to try and challenge the original Dark Lord. But they're also on their own. The Valar tell them that basically, because of things they did on their way out of the Undying Lands, which I won't get into today, they're not allowed to come back. And Galadriel is included under that ban. This actually, all of that explains how Galadriel behaves in The Lord of the Rings. Because if you've read the Silmarillion, you understand the context of the Mirror of Galadriel scene. Because in the Silmarillion, Galadriel is a proud elvish lord, second most powerful of the Noldor. She wants to establish her own realm in Middle-earth and rule. She's ambitious. And that's why she returns. She's not part of Fëanor's revolt, because she never supported Fëanor. But she returns to Middle-earth anyways, so she gets caught up in the ban. So if you've read the Silmarillion and you know this about Galadriel, you know that when Frodo offers the ring and Galadriel starts to go into overdrive mode, that the struggle is real. That was actually a side of Galadriel that is established in earlier writings outside of The Lord of the Rings. That he is offering her everything that she wanted. But by the time of The Lord of the Rings, Galadriel has become wise enough to recognize that her dream has too high of a cost. She can't have Sauron remaining an enemy of the free people be the price of her ambition. Which is really awesome and set up and supported by the Silmarillion. And that's really what the Silmarillion is all about. The stories in it are great, and they provide more background to things you see in The Lord of the Rings, but doesn't lend itself to, like, three movies the way that, like, it's not one continuous narrative. It's a mix of history with epic stories thrown in, and you would need at least one, maybe two movies to get you to the first of the major epic stories. And that's why I always say an animated series would be incredible, like a TV series. I think for movies, you would need the right adaptation, because you would really, the setup for the Silmarillion is immense. The payoff is incredible, what Tolkien finished of it. So I would love to see it someday, but I feel like more likely the adaptation you would get would be like Beren and Lúthien, with none of the backstory. Just basically, like, go get this MacGuffin. And it's like, okay. And that's where I'm just like, Like, I want it to really land the way it should, because it's an epic story of the First Order. And I feel like if you don't do it right, you're going to fumble that. And then everyone's going to be like, well, that wasn't really that great. And it's like, no, because you kind of took out a ton of it. And I'll just do one more aside on this. All-Star Superman is probably the best Superman story I've ever read. There is an adaptation of it. It's a condensed adaptation that has about half the story. What's there of it is good, but you took out like 50% of a perfect story. And it's just, you see, like, I could show it to someone and they could get a sense of how good All-Star Superman was, but it's not going to land the way that the perfect 12-part story by Grant Morrison is going to land because you're missing major stuff. You took out like half of the things. You can only remove so much and still keep the same vibe. That's always the concern with that. And that's kind of my concern with the Silmarillion movie. So I just wanted to clarify my thoughts on that. I know this has probably made things more confusing if you haven't followed it before, but I did want to share my knowledge on this topic because it does come out. And probably the person who posted that thing about the Silmarillion movie was like the shameless poop pile stirrer, and I got trolled again. But it's fine because it did get me thinking about what a Lord of the Rings movie should look like. Not Lord of the Rings, a Silmarillion movie should look like. And I think it is possible. It would just need to be the right thing, and it would need to be a lengthy series. It would have to be someone who's really committed. And I mean, honestly, I'm a little disappointed Amazon didn't do that when they made The Rings of Power. They were like looking for a story to tell. I think they passed on the Silmarillion, and I can understand why, because you definitely would need to have the long game. But some of the payoffs in there, once you have the setup in place, it would be incredible. And that's kind of the thing. It's like, you know, the Silmarillion is almost like the secret society of Tolkien fans. There's like those hardcore fans who somehow managed to read it and get through it and know that there's like a lot of great parts in it, but it doesn't exactly put its best foot forward for the newcomer. And then the only other thing I'd add is Unfinished Tales, if you've never read that, is also pretty interesting. It has a lot of good stuff in it. And it's just the thing with Tolkien, I guess the last thing I'll add is that he was like a scribbler and a rewriter and a reviser. And a lot of things in Tolkien, like there's different versions of it. And his son, after he died, his son basically took the notes and compiled the Silmarillion into something of a finished text. So, but like the history of Galadriel, there's like several different versions of Galadriel that Tolkien sort of workshopped and never really concluded. So with something like that, the best you can do is read all of them and then sort of come to the one that you like the best or that you think fits the best. And I certainly do have my own thoughts on that, but it's not always cut and dried. There's different versions of things where he would write and rewrite. And yes, I've actually read the different versions of things that he does it, because there's little things that I like about each. Unfinished Tales like has the part where Gandalf is meeting with the dwarves before the Hobbit, convincing them to take Bilbo. Like, that's actually a fully fleshed out scene, definitely worth reading. And there's some other good things in Unfinished Tales. A lot of it's very interesting stuff if you love Middle Earth. I have never read the history of Middle Earth. It's in entirety. That is a bit too much for me. That's like all of the notes. You're basically looking over the shoulder of Tolkien as he's writing a lot of stuff. It's interesting. There's like more maps and stuff in there too. But I've never quite dove that far in. I kind of like the things to be finished manuscripts or close to it. And then the last thing, I promise this is the last thing. The first thing that Tolkien ever wrote about Middle Earth was The Fall of Gondolin, which was like the culminating tragedy of the Silmarillion, which is like this elven city of Gondolin, which, you know, is brought up in The Hobbit. Like, that's where the swords that Thorin and Gandalf have were forged. Gandalf's sword was the sword of the King of Gondolin. I have no idea how that wound up in some penny ante troll's hoard in the Third Age, but like, yeah, that was the first thing he ever wrote. I think that was around the time that he was serving in World War I, and he wrote The Fall of Gondolin as a poem, which is basically about when it was the final elvish kingdom destroyed by the Dark Lord, and the original war between the original Dark Lord and the elves. And then I know I've said one last thing, but Beren and Lúthien, another thing that would make it cool is that one of the heavies in it is Sauron. Like, Sauron from the Dark Lord from the Lord of the Rings is in the story of Beren and Lúthien. Like, he's one of the heavies. It's where you actually see him in the Silmarillion. So he's one of the villains in that story. So I think that would be a great hook. That's probably why you would just see the Beren and Lúthien movie. And it wouldn't really have all the context and backstory with it that I think would be essential. But, you know, you would get to see Sauron, like first age Sauron when he was still a shapeshifter and all that. So that's my two cents on the Silmarillion movie. I know I did some posting about it, but I've tried to resolve to be open-minded on this question. But honestly, I do think it's just the poop pile stirrers because they know it'll get a response from people like me occasionally. But it's still fun to entertain the premise. I just don't see it happening anytime soon. That's all the time I have for today. I hope you enjoyed it. And yeah, go get the Tolkien Atlas. That definitely will help you make sense of the greater history of Middle Earth. And the maps in it by Karen Wynn Fonstad are just amazing. It's a beautiful book. I have both editions of it, and it's one of my prized possessions. So highly recommend it. Till next time, take care.